Less than one day away from the first in-person voting in the 2020 general election in Texas, and a major legal fight still in play over absentee ballots. The latest today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. A bitter back and forth over drop-off points for mail-in ballots, even as they're already being collected. What this last-minute legal battle portends for an unprecedented number of Texas voters. Also, answers to listener questions about mail-in voting and the pandemic, an unexpected boom in natural gas prices, and going gone? Historic letters under lock and key in Mexico City, discovered at auction. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 12th day of October 2020. I'm David Brown, and we are now hours away from the first in-person votes being cast in Texas. How confident are you that your vote will count? A new poll by the University of Texas and the Texas Tribune finds not only that fewer than half of all registered voters in Texas are confident that Americans will trust the results of the presidential election, but even fewer Texans say they themselves will trust the results or are unsure they will trust the results regardless of who wins. One thing Democrats and Republicans appear to agree on, according to the polling. It does little to enhance one's confidence in the process to have on the eve of in-person voting in Texas a battle royale remaining over an important procedure during this pandemic. Absentee voting, especially as never before, are so many Texans planning to cast their ballots by mail owing to the ongoing pandemic. On Saturday, a federal appeals court, the Fifth Circuit, set up an 11th-hour legal battle over an order from Governor Abbott limiting drop-off points for absentee ballots to one per county. A move that many Democrats see as a desperate attempt at voter suppression. The governor is justifying the one drop-off point per county rule as an effort to fight fraud. And though a district court late last week rejected the governor's order, this weekend's appeals court decision puts the question back into play. Taylor Goldenstein covers state politics for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News, and she joins us now. Taylor, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
Where do we stand right now with this back and forth? It's kind of hard to keep up when it comes to whether or not Texas counties can have more than one drop-off location. If I'm counting correctly, the answer, at least for now, is no, you can only have one drop-off location?
Correct.
Okay. So what does this mean for those counties in Texas, notably Travis and Harris counties, that had already set up multiple drop-off locations? Because right now, you have this question still in play, even though there is this hold order from the Fifth Circuit.
Right. So, I mean, since the order came in Friday, none of them had quite reopened yet, but they were planning to. Obviously, this was disappointing to them. There is early voting starting Tuesday. So, you know, we're slowly running out of days where those drop-off boxes would be useful. So, it's really kind of, like you said, one of those last-minute legal battles that might be, you know, creeping closer and closer toward Election Day.
We should go back and set up some of this history. This whole question began when Governor Abbott issued an order that Texas county clerks could not set up multiple drop-off points for absentee ballots, correct?
So the governor's assertion is that there will be more voter fraud if multiple locations are allowed to exist at county annexes and other offices. Part of the order was to include poll watchers in the process, to allow poll watchers to be at the drop-off points. And his idea was that if you didn't have, you know, if you had multiple locations, it would be more difficult to have those poll watchers across all of them.
Of course, this was challenged by many Democrats as an attempt at voter suppression in a year when many saw a greater possibility than in almost 20 years of Texas Democrats retaking the House, and of course, a competitive state now in the presidential race, according to the polls. That went on to federal district court, and there, what did the judge have to say?
The judge sided with the plaintiffs there and said, you know, this is a burden on the right to vote, especially for the elderly who will have to travel farther to get to the drop-off boxes and potentially be in longer lines and be exposed to COVID for longer. And for minorities who, you know, may not live close to the main office or the center of a county.
The question of whether or not this constitutes voter suppression, has that been an active issue in the ping-ponging back and forth in the courts?
Yes, for sure. The plaintiffs have basically said that this is one of many acts of voter suppression by the governor lately through the use of these executive orders.
Okay, and it appears that the district court agreed with that complaint. But then Attorney General Ken Paxton appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and now we have what exactly? It's not a complete ruling, but it's sort of a temporary injunction?
Right. So now they've basically given kind of emergency action, but we'll need kind of a longer term stay by the court before they can really hear out the whole process and the whole appeal.
Well, clearly this isn't the end of the road on this question, because this is just a temporary order. What happens next? What's the next shoe to drop?
Next, they'll issue a probably more lasting stay, which would last through the end of the appeal, and they will hear the appeal and hopefully issue an opinion soon.
And what about election officials and county clerks? What do they have to say about this back and forth? Any concerns about voter confusion out there, or questions of confidence in the process overall?
Definitely. And that was actually something that the federal judge brought up, was that, you know, there's this longstanding precedent, don't change things too soon, too close to the election. That's actually something the Fifth Circuit itself brought up when it didn't reinstate straight ticket voting. To them, you know, Taking them away would cause more confusion than just allowing them to remain open.
Any evidence been presented in court that multiple drop-off points compromise election security?
No. In fact, the lawyers even pointed to even the appearance of voter fraud. So it's a pretty vague or broad assertion.
Taylor Goldenstein covers state politics for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News. We'll link to her latest at TexasStandard.org. Taylor, thanks again.
Thank you.
Since we've been talking about absentee ballots, we should address one of the elephants in the room here, namely, how is mail-in voting supposed to work? From now until Election Day, our Texas Decides project has been answering your questions about voting. And today, the Standard's own Shelley Brisbane takes us on the journey of an absentee ballot.
Sarah Goodman sent her application for a mail-in ballot before the primary election in March. The 68-year-old Austin resident opted to vote by mail because of COVID-19. On her application, she checked the box that would make sure she'd receive a mail-in ballot for all elections this year. Her question for Texas Decides is about her November 3rd ballot.
I would like to know when Travis County is going to be mailing out the mail-in ballots. So I want to know when I should expect to receive it.
Right now, the answer is unclear. Normally, there are a lot of steps along the way between requesting your mail-in ballot and having it counted. And this year, requests for absentee ballots are at an all-time high, says Travis County Clerk Dana DeBeauvoir.
We did have about 63,000 total by mail requests.
And it's not just in Austin.
For lack of a better word, we're drowning in applications to vote by mail.
Malin Huntley is election administrator for Potter County, which encompasses part of Amarillo. She says there are a lot of steps to verifying eligibility and preparing a ballot.
Once we receive the application, of course, you have to make sure that they are registered to vote. You make sure that the application is in Potter County, and assuming everything is filled out as it's supposed to be, then it is received into one of our software systems where we track every step of the vote-by-mail process.
Huntley's staff compares the signature on the application to their copy of the voter's registration card, and then they assemble a packet.
It includes a carrier envelope, a ballot envelope, the green envelope in which the ballot goes. There's a letter from the Secretary of State. There's some special instructions for this year, and there's a ballot in there.
Travis County's Dana DeBeauvoir says she's been mailing ballots out to voters in waves. But Sarah's still wondering where her ballot is. What she didn't know is that there is a way for her to find out.
Go to votetravis.com. They'll see a button that says voter lookup, and you press the button, capital BBM status.
BBM stands for ballot by mail, and you'll have to scroll a bit to find it. Turns out Sarah's application is on file, but her ballot hasn't been mailed to her yet. Unfortunately, not all Texas counties provide this kind of online lookup. Go online or call your county elections office to find out if yours does. When her ballot arrives, Sarah will be able to make her choices, sign it, and mail it back, and it must be postmarked by Election Day. But Sarah isn't taking any chances.
We've already seen that there's places where you can drop off your mail-in ballots effective October 1, yet I don't even have my mail-in ballot yet.
She says when she gets that ballot, she plans to drive the 15 miles from her home to Travis County's main office to deliver it in person.
Voters can drive up, show ID, sign a signature roster, and then put their by-mail ballot directly into the ballot box.
It's important to remember that you can't deliver a mail-in ballot to a polling place, and you can only deliver your own ballot. Once Sarah drops off her ballot, it goes into the hands of election staff.
There's a long-standing procedure for ballot by mail that is very tedious and very manual. Everything with by mail, there's nothing automated about by mail.
Workers pull the sealed ballot envelope out of the outer envelope, the one with the voter's identification information. They unseal the ballot and prepare it for scanning. Then they lock it in a vault. Staff then use the information from the outer envelope to update the roster of mail-in voters.
Once we start in on early voting, we are required to upload the list of everybody who voted to the Texas Secretary of State. And so you can go in there and you will know that we have received your ballot.
Ballots won't be tallied until Election Day, but Sarah and other voters can track the status of their ballots by going online to votetexas.gov. County election officials say that if you want to reduce the chance of something going wrong along the way, the best thing you can do is to mail in or hand deliver that ballot as soon as possible. For the Texas Standard, I'm Shelley Brisbane.
Joining us on this Monday, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello, Wells.
Hello, David. With the kickoff of Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court confirmation hearings, the talk of politics watchers on social media, unsurprisingly there, I might add. On our Facebook page, lots of chatter. Gabrielle Gordon calls the confirmation a shoo-in. She says it's sort of a waste of taxpayer money because she assumes that the Republican-led Senate committee will approve her confirmation. Janice Hitchcock says this isn't justice, this is partisan politics, something that was never intended to impact the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, over on Twitter, Rachel says she'll skip the hearings today. She says they're mainly theater and pointless is information that's useful to us in most ways. She says she'll listen to a podcast instead and might as well tune into something productive and interesting. Just a sampling of the opinions out there. Lots of talk about Ted Cruz, him appearing remotely in quarantine after coming into contact with Senator Mike Lee, who tested positive for coronavirus and who himself is there in person without a mask. That said, out of the 10-day period after which he was diagnosed. Just one of the stories we're watching today, David. I'll be back with more later in the broadcast.
Yeah, a lot of people watching that big story. And, of course, if there's anything breaking in the course of the broadcast, we'll bring you updates. You can keep up with all the news at texasstandard.org. Wells back at 35. It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Across Texas, many of the state's most vulnerable are struggling to cover costs during the pandemic, chief among those costs, the rent. Rent relief programs and the CDC eviction moratorium are meant to protect them, but many are still forced out without an official eviction order. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval brings us the story of one Houston family.
I met Cristina Rea, her boyfriend, and his mom at their trailer park in North Houston. All three wear masks and show me around. They've been almost 3 months without electricity during some of Houston's hottest months.
Al tercer día que vino, solo vino y cortó todo.
Rea explains how their landlord cut off power when they were a few days late with rent. It's not right, she says. The family had been tenants there for more than a decade.
Tenía que ser un poco tolerante después de tantos años que han vivido aquí.
Now they're sleeping in their silver car on and off. Even if they could pay rent, they can't stay in the trailer anymore. Juan Miranda tries to show me inside.
I barely can open the door.
The roof has partially collapsed. Debris is everywhere.
Oh my gosh.
Everything's knocked out. So I lost everything from inside.
When was that?
When the storm hit, the Hurricane Beta.
The smell of rot escapes through the wedged open door. Inside, the family's clothes, shoes, and microwave are all likely destroyed. It's the latest in a string of poor luck since the pandemic. The couples struggled to find work, which is why they were late on rent. Rea hasn't received any government aid due to her immigration status, and Miranda didn't qualify for unemployment because he works informal construction jobs. They don't know who to turn to for help. Josephine Lee works with Latino immigrant families through the nonprofit El Pueblo Primero. She says many families are going through this. It's called self-eviction.
All this time, the landlord has been pressuring them through different tactics, right? Giving them notices to vacate, putting like a padlock on their door. And so in response, some people, you know, have been self-evicting because they don't want to go to court.
So those are the people that are getting evicted that are invisible.
That's Reverend Ed Gomez from San Pablo's Episcopal Church. He says he's seen people lose out on rent relief because their apartment is under another name.
They don't have leases in their names and so forth. They don't have utilities in their names. It's all under the person who they get to sign for them. And like that, there's probably thousands. It's the invisible Houston, you know?
Guadalupe Fernandez is with the Tahereh Justice Center and serves on the county's eviction task force. She gets frustrated about access to aid for families like the Mirandas.
My intention from the beginning has been, if you are not addressing and targeting the most vulnerable, right? Like, who are you actually helping?
Nonprofits, churches, and informal community groups have picked up the slack, and many funds have been depleted. Catholic Charities of Houston, for example, has provided over $1.6 million for mostly rent and utilities since March. They don't expect the need to let up anytime soon. For now, the Miranda family is trying to get back on their feet with only the clothes on their backs.
Me he tenido que levantar y estar pensando ahora qué voy a hacer mañana si no voy a trabajar.
Rea says it's hard to sleep thinking about where she's going to get money to eat. She has two young daughters who are staying with their aunt for now. She hopes she can reunite with them soon. I'm Elizabeth Troval in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Oil demand may have taken a tumble this year amid the COVID pandemic, as we've talked about here on The Standard in the past. But apparently it's not all gloom and doom for the energy industry in Texas. It turns out natural gas is actually on quite solid footing right now, as liquefied natural gas exports are up from LNG terminals along the Gulf Coast. Joining us again is Matt Smith. He's Director of Commodity Research for Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you, David.
You know, I was thinking back to the early summer when we were talking about how low natural gas prices were, as, you know, I believe they're 25-year low, if I'm not mistaken. But now, as I understand it, there's been quite a dramatic turnaround. What's going on?
Yeah, absolutely fascinating turnaround. It just shows you how things can turn around so quickly. Back in late June when we were talking, yeah, prices were close to $1.50 in MMBTU. As you mentioned there, the lowest in a quarter of a century. And it was because we were seeing a huge amount of US LNG export cargoes being cancelled. And this was because on a global basis, we were knee deep in coronavirus lockdowns, which meant the world was oversupplied with natural gas at a time that demand was getting crushed. Now, fast forward just a few months later, and prices are just shy of $3 an MMBTU, basically double from where they were, at a one-year high, and the winter months are looking considerably higher than that as well.
I want to make sure I understand something, though. What's driving this rise? Is it a lack of supply? Because there had been a lot of concern about getting LNG from out in the oil fields of West Texas back to the coast. Or are we talking about a resurgence in demand due to a sense that the pandemic is perhaps waning? How do you read this?
This is kind of the strange thing, because typically the driver for natural gas prices has been storage. So when storage levels are high versus their historical benchmarks, prices are low, and vice versa. There's this inverse relationship. When storage is low, prices are high. But that relationship has broken down because storage is actually currently at a record high for the time of year. What is happening instead, Dave, is that prices are rallying on a big drop in natural gas production, as well as expectations of a cold winter, you know, something that we've been able to dodge for the last couple of years. So really, it's a double whammy, a bit of both. The expectation of an ongoing lack of supply while demand picks up due to both LNG exports as well as the expectation of heating demand coming through too.
Well, then what does this mean if the economics of liquefied natural gas suggest that prices are going up? One would naturally expect production to go up. Is that going to be happening as you see it?
No, that's not going to happen. So, you know, from my perspective, all paths lead back to energy, whatever you look at. And seemingly all paths for energy in the U.S. lead back to Texas. Hence, the drop in natural gas production that we're seeing that is driving prices higher, it's actually the result of lower associated gas being produced in Texas and particularly in the Permian Basin. So the reason this is happening is because oil production has dropped in the Permian Basin as well as elsewhere after the oil price crashed back in the spring when prices turned negative. And as oil production looks set to move lower as we move into 2021, natural gas production is expected to continue to drop as well.
When it comes to natural gas production, how are things looking for Texas, given, for instance, recent hurricanes? How has Hurricane Delta, for example, affected operations on the Gulf Coast?
Well, it's caused the majority of ports in Texas and Louisiana to temporarily close, so they're opening back up again. But imports and exports of oil and products have both been halted temporarily. Delta made landfall at Lake Charles, Louisiana there, which is still recovering from a direct hit from Hurricane Laura. So you are seeing that impact. Hopefully it's going to be, we're seeing the flows of imports and exports getting back up and running, but we may see some damage to some of the places at Lake Charles there.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research for Clipper Data, bringing us the latest on a surprising uptick in natural gas costs. Matt, thanks again.
Thank you, David.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A confirmation hearing for President Trump's Supreme Court pick began this morning. Republican U.S. Senator John Cornyn defended his party's decision to move forward with Amy Coney Barrett's nomination during Friday's debate with his Democratic challenger, M.J. Hagar.
The reason why the left and people like M.J. are so upset on these Supreme Court appointments is because they view judges as legislators wearing black robes.
Hagar criticized the GOP for holding hearings when voters have already cast ballots.
Where is this urgency to push through this nominee, which, by the way, they wouldn't have this kind of urgency if they thought they were going to hold on to the Senate and the White House?
Early voting in Texas for the November election starts tomorrow. Today marks 1 year since a white Fort Worth police officer fatally shot Tatiana Jefferson, a 28-year-old black woman, through a window in her home. KERA's Miranda Suarez reports on a car parade yesterday in Jefferson's honor.
A few dozen people gathered in a parking lot Sunday to decorate their cars before driving to the house where Jefferson was killed. Octavia Woodard used a white marker to cover her car windows with phrases like "protect black women" and "say her name."
This car parade, a lot of people will see her name on our cars and they'll say, who is a Tatiana? Maybe they'll Google it and they'll say, oh, wow, we didn't know this happened, or, oh, wow, I forgot that did happen.
Woodard also wrote "Convict Aaron Dean" on her window. Dean's the former Fort Worth police officer who shot Jefferson. He's been charged with murder and is awaiting trial. COVID-19 has delayed court proceedings. I'm Miranda Suarez in Fort Worth.
The chair of the Republican Party of Texas continues to oppose COVID-19 restrictions imposed by GOP Governor Greg Abbott. Alan West spoke Saturday during a protest at the state capitol.
Government is not in existence to protect your health. Yes. Government is in existence to protect your rights.
West and other Republicans previously sued Abbott to block his order extending early voting, but the Texas Supreme Court rejected the challenge. And the CDC confirms a splash pad storage tank in the city of Lake Jackson created an environment where a brain-eating amoeba could be viable, leading to the death of a six-year-old boy last month. City Manager Modesto Mundo said Friday they never want this to happen again.
Therefore, the splash pad is closed, and it will not reopen or be converted into anything else until after discussion with the family and our city council.
Lake Jackson, south of Houston, rescinded its boil water notice last week. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Department of Agriculture. Because of educators and school nutrition professionals, students are taught about local products and nutrition to make smarter choices about eating. More at farmfreshfriday.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As we've done most weeks during the pandemic, it's time once again to turn to your questions about COVID-19. We've been inviting listeners to send in questions about the coronavirus or what to do about it. And we'll get some answers now from Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
It's great to be back, David.
So last time we spoke, Dr. Campbell, we talked about the changing guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, when it comes to aerosol transmission of COVID-19. Now what we're talking about here are COVID particles spreading between people who are more than 6 feet apart. What's the most recent guidance on this, and how should people behave based on the best available information?
That's a great question, and the CDC has been inconsistent in the past. However, most recently, they have confirmed that, in fact, spread does occur by aerosolized very small particles and greater than 6 feet from people. So I think that it's quite clear that those things did happen, have happened, just like the church choir incident I mentioned a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that people understand that despite the fact that that does occur, it certainly appears that the predominant mode of transmission is the droplet particles that are going to be present 6 feet or less between individuals.
So it is rare for it to be spread by air, the aerosol. It's more the droplets that we're talking about. What do people do then? Do they avoid any public contact altogether? Are masks a sufficient safeguard? What would you tell them?
I really believe that's the crux of the issue at this point, is just how safe can you be? And I believe that aerosolizing the COVID virus is a very, very low risk kind of spread, and that certainly places like outdoors and in places where there is a high amount of ventilation will minimize the transmission even farther. So I would say that to be very, very careful, people should be social distancing 6 feet away, and then when they're outside and in ventilated places, despite the fact that they're at much decreased risk, never hurts to have a face covering.
Let's turn to this question sent to us by an anonymous listener through our website. They write, I contracted COVID-19. Is it effective to use a toothbrush UV sanitizer to disinfect the brush head while or after I recover, or should I just throw the thing out?
I think the use of UV light is a very, very effective way of neutralizing the COVID-19. I can't see a reason to throw out a toothbrush that's being used by one individual. And I think that the risk of reinfection, particularly in someone who's using UV sanitizing, is extremely low.
Finally, we received a couple of comments from listeners like Twitter user It's Michelle CB, who say that they plan to continue wearing masks once the pandemic is over. Is this a practice that maybe we should all consider adopting? Is mask wearing, do you think, going to become a common part of everyday life here in the U.S.? What's your take on this?
Other countries have been very successful during periods such as flu season in minimizing the severe effect of influenza in terms of both morbidity and mortality. I believe that a common seasonal use of masks, particularly in heavy transmission periods such as the winter months would be a great way of minimizing the spread of a number of deadly viruses and other kinds of infectious agents that are picked up through respiratory means. So I'm all for the idea of at least cold weather use of masking.
Yeah, I know that's a question that's run through a lot of people's minds as we think about what the new normal might look like. We've been talking with Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio. We've been having him join us regularly over the course of this pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask, you can look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus, where you'll find a form to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again. Good to talk with you, sir.
It's always a pleasure to help.
Pabst Blue Ribbon is relocating to Texas. San Antonio Express News reports that the Beers announced it'll be moving its headquarters from Los Angeles to the Alamo City. PBR already has a foothold in San Antonio, to be honest. It's operated an office there for the past 5 years with about 60 employees. And long before that, Pabst was brewed in San Antonio for a while after the company closed its Milwaukee brewery in 1996. It operated out of the former Pearl Brewery until 2001 when the plant shuttered. Right now, no plans to resume brewing the beer in San Antonio, but Pabst says that they wouldn't rule it out in the future. Coming up on 39 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. There's a whole lot more of the Standard just ahead. Stay with us.
Did you ever sit straight up in bed with something circling around your head and you swat at it as it whizzes by and it's just one pesky little fly? You shake your head and twitch your nose and settle down to sweet repose. And when you're just about to doze, fly trouble.
My name is Wizzy Brown and I'm with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service and I work with insects. Something that is closely related to fruit flies but is a different type of fly is called a forward fly, but they're also known as scuttle flies, humpbacked flies, or coffin flies. So the humpbacked fly comes because they have this large humped back. The scuttle fly name comes because instead of flying, a lot of times they'll just kind of run along the surface of something instead of flying away when they're disturbed. While they can get into rotting vegetation like the fruit flies, they will also get into fecal material. They'll get into any sort of wet organic matter. So slime buildup on drains. I've seen them, if you have a loose tile and that dirt gets under there and then it gets wet, they'll get in that. I've seen forage flies coming out of mops in commercial kitchens that are kind of funky. And in regular kitchens, if you use a sponge, you want to sanitize that on occasion, because if not, they will lay eggs on that and they can actually breed in those areas as well. And then, of course, you know, since they are also known as coffin flies, sometimes they may be an indicator that there is something dead. And usually if you have something dead, you will have something other than just the forage flies. A lot of times you'll have flesh flies or blow flies as well if it's signifying something dead. The other gross area that scuttle flies can come out of and it could be a signifier for is sewer lines breaking or septic systems having cracks in them. They will need to have their source located and dealt with, because if you're just treating for the adults, they're just going to keep coming and coming and coming. So you really need to find where they're coming from and actually take care of that source, and then that will take care of the problem. I'm Wizzy Brown for the Texas Standard.
Wizzy Brown is a program specialist for the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service and our resident insect expert. Something bugging you? Send us a question and we'll try to swat it down. TexasStandard.org. One could argue that there's no event in Mexican history as significant as the landing of Hernan Cortes on the Yucatan Peninsula in 1519. The Spanish conquistador came to conquer and colonize, which he did to great effect, wresting control from the Aztec Empire in a bloody and ruthless campaign. Still, the few documents that Cortes left behind are precious, which is why they're held behind tight security in Mexico's national archives. Or at least that's where they're supposed to be. A recent auction listing, however, shows that a few seem to have somehow slipped out. Lauren Villagran will help us pick up the story from here. She is a reporter for the El Paso Times. Lauren, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David.
So, riddle me this. How did some of the documents that should be under padlock in Mexico City wind up in an auction? What sort of auction was this?
So these are auctions in New York, and that's the question that historians in Mexico are asking. I heard from a longtime source in Oaxaca, actually, about a student who had noticed that certain papers he was looking for in the National Archive were no longer there. Oh. And the historians know they were there, not because Mexico City actually has a detailed inventory, but because a Spanish researcher had a few years ago taken detailed photos of almost everything in this particular corner of the archive known as Hospital de Jesus. And they have proof, essentially, that the documents were in this archive and all of a sudden were showing up on auction house catalogs in New York, many of them already sold.
There's no question that these letters were definitely held in the National Archives and no chance that they were unaccounted for up to this point.
For the letters, the nine papers that the historians reported, they say they have the photographs of each and every one of them.
I smell something fishy. Are there any clues as to how they disappeared in the first place? Were they known to have been missing except for this one researcher who had discovered some kind of gap in the records?
Well, it was a team of researchers in Mexico, both in Mexico City and Oaxaca, and also in Spain, who discovered what they believe is a theft of these documents. They reported it to Mexican authorities this past summer. Unfortunately, seven of the nine documents had already sold. Now, there's clearly some kind of leak from the archive across the border and into New York. Just a couple of weeks ago, Swan Auction Galleries in New York City had to pull several lots from an auction of printed and manuscript Americana after they heard from the Mexican government. Swan wouldn't say exactly what items were on the block this time, but in addition to the items already sold, there were a number of other items that pertained to Cortes manuscripts that were pulled from auction.
Let's talk a little bit about their importance to Mexican history. What are experts telling you about these documents?
So it's a miracle that these documents survived 500 years, and they're precious, particularly to researchers who say that taking even one of these documents is like ripping a page out of a book. It's no longer possible to fully understand, you know, the full complex history. Now, Mexico has a very complex history in which documents and items from the conquest aren't valued in the same way that items or archaeological objects from the indigenous period are because of the bloody and ruthless nature of Cortes and the conquest. So researchers, though, say that it's impossible to understand modern Mexico and the modern Mexican context without understanding, you know, this period of the conquest. And that's in part why these documents are so important.
So what do these documents actually say, these missing documents?
So there's a variety of documents. Some of them are fascinating. You have Cortes telling an assistant to receive a new governor to Mexico because, quote, if you do not, I will be very angry. You see Cortes's personality come out in these documents. There are also letters that talk about enslaved people, that talk about his business interests. And you really can get a sense of what that time period was like.
Well, given the provenance, given the fact that there are existing photographs that document these documents, what's going to happen with these letters? Are they going to be repatriated to Mexico? What about those who may have purchased some on the open market?
So I spoke to the FBI about this. Now, I will say that Mexican authorities declined to comment for my story, citing an open investigation. We do know that the Mexican embassy did contact that New York auction house, Swan Auction Galleries. So we know the Mexican government now is acting. The FBI told me that there are a few avenues for the restitution of cultural patrimony that has been illegally stolen or smuggled across the border. Mm-hmm. One of those avenues is that the buyer is simply informed and may make, you know, the right choice to return an item that was, you know, proved to be stolen. If the buyer or the seller can be identified and it is found, you know, from a federal investigation that they were somehow involved, well, there can be a criminal prosecution as well.
Laura Villagran is a reporter for the El Paso Times. We'll have a link to her amazing story on the stolen letters of Hernan Cortez at texasstandard.org. Lauren, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. After the police killing of George Floyd earlier this year, demands intensified for local governments to change the names of public institutions with names tied to the Confederacy. In Midland, for instance, the school district approved a move to strip Robert E. Lee's name from the city's high school at a cost of more than $3 million overall. Since then, a battle's raged over what to call the campus next. And as Marfa Public Radio's Mitch Borden reports, when it's all over, possibly as early as this week, a trace of the Confederate general's name may end up staying.
This could be the last year for the Midland Lee Rebels on the football field, at least with that name. Friday night lights shine over their first game of the season. Fans cheer. A big Rebel Nation banner hangs from the stands. The school's drill team, the Dixie Dolls, dances for the crowd. Midland's Robert E. Lee High School opened in 1961 as a segregated campus. Today, football is what it's known for. The Rebels took home 3 state championships in the late 90s and early aughts. Generations of families have graduated from the high school commonly referred to as Midland Lee. When the district decided to rename it this summer, the backlash was swift. Social media blew up. A lawsuit was filed. Alumni organized demonstrations. At one, I met Timothy Lyles, a 1976 Lee grad.
For 60 years, that name has stood. Why is it wrong today? Why was it not wrong the second year it was up there? Why was it not wrong the 50th year it was up there?
Dozens were at the rally that day. After I took a photo of a couple flying a Confederate flag, Angela Boswell approached me. She graduated from Lee in 1988 and told me organizers asked people not to bring stuff like that. Boswell said they're fighting for Midland Lee's legacy, not Robert E. Lee's.
I don't remember being racist in high school. I had friends of all shades, colors, creeds, sexual orientation, and everything. So why do they have to throw the white person under the bus?
Those against renaming the school have pretty much agreed. If the district is going to drop the Confederate general's name, it needs to find a way to keep the school Midland Lee.
We have no issue and we agree that it's time that Robert E. needs to be taken off the building. We agree with that.
Sunny Johnson's the mother of 2 Midland Lee students.
There's absolutely no sense in sitting there taking the legacy and exactly what put Midland on the map. Why would you sit there and remove all of that?
The name didn't make us. We made the name.
That's John Norman. He's on the school's renaming committee and is also Midland's only black city councilman. Norman's totally against any part of the general's name staying. In the 90s, he was a Midland Lee Rebel football star. Norman explains it was hard for his dad to watch his son play football while his school celebrated a racist legacy. Back then, Confederate battle flags flew over games, and the marching band blasted Dixie after every touchdown.
They try to make it seem like it was so long ago, but my dad had to drink from a colored water fountain. My dad had to enter through the back door.
And your dad had to hear Dixie played while his sons were on the football field.
Every time. We scored a lot of touchdowns, and they'd strike their song up.
Confederate rivalries like that have stopped. Now, Norman says, removing the general's name is the next logical and ethical step.
Robert E. Lee fought to keep my ancestors enslaved. For me to honor someone like that is really kind of ridiculous.
So what should the school be called? Well, there are three official choices on the table. Midland Carver Lee High School, Midland Tell City High School, and the current top pick, Midland Legacy of Equality and Excellence, an acronym for Lee. If the school board chooses to go with the acronym, they wouldn't be the first in Texas. A school in San Antonio did something similar a few years back, but that option wouldn't satisfy John Norman or others like Ashley Kemp.
They're trying to make it racism light. They're trying to make it palatable. Like, oh, well, no, we're going to turn it into something more positive.
Kemp's been a vocal advocate for completely renaming the school. And the ferocity of Lee supporters, she says,
it's exposing the white supremacy that still reigns.
Still, Kemp's confident that someday Lee will be removed.
That's why I feel like we already won, because they're fighting a battle that they've already lost.
Back on the football field, the Midland Lee Rebels just won their first game of the season. What they'll go by next season is in the hands of Midland ISD's school board. It could make a final decision as soon as this week. I'm Mitch Borden in Midland.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar monitoring the talk of Texas on this Monday, one day before the first in-person balloting in Texas. It's hard to believe we are that. No, it's a little hard. We've been talking about it and talking about it, and now here we are. You got to be registered, of course, but that deadline has passed.
Yeah,
a lot of people ready to cast that ballot. What are you hearing on social media today?
Well, we're hearing about that, David, on our Facebook and Twitter accounts and elsewhere. People very fired up about early voting coming. Starting tomorrow, Ollie Trout says, how about people vote for what's best for our country, her people, and our democracy? Don't let hate win. Ollie says that people have lost sight that politicians are public servants that divide us while they stuff their pockets, break the rules, and give their pals tax breaks while putting the burden on the middle and lower class. Quite the rally there to head on out to the polls. And also people talking about, this topic we've been covering on the show, this sort of back and forth over what is the deal with the drop boxes for mail-in ballots. The latest news there, obviously, we covered being limited to one per county per the governor's original order. Christy Acton says that her mother-in-law had an hour-long round-trip drive to drop off her ballot here in Austin. Christy says she can't imagine how long it would take in Houston, obviously a sprawling metropolis there that had several drop-offs originally planned. And again, echoing what we've heard from some folks there as well, Connor McAnally says the move is a blatant attempt at voter suppression. So many people are rather upset about that, although as we've heard, the official response from Texas Republican leaders saying this is done to try and what they describe as protect the integrity of the vote this season. So right around the corner. And you know, one thing I would add, David, we saw a tweet earlier from a listener echoing, I guess you could call it some disinformation I've seen floating around out there. So voting has been extended by another week here in Texas. Kicks off tomorrow. But we have seen some concerns that if this were challenged, as it has been challenged by some fellow Republicans seeking to do away with that extra week of voting, that votes cast during that first week might not count. Now,
disinformation.
That is decidedly disinformation. And I just wanted to clear that up because we have seen that floating around on Facebook posts and stuff. There is no way that that could happen. And to my knowledge, I think that last attempt at striking that extra week down was just dispatched in court recently. So folks should have no reason to fear casting their ballot in that first week of early voting.
No, indeed. And now comes the time to cast that ballot, Texas. We'd love to hear from you about what's making news in your part of the Lone Star State. You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. And as always, keep up with the news 24/7 over at texasstandard.org. We'll be back here on the radio tomorrow, keeping you updated on that first day of in-person voting, and we hope you will join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.